Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Detroit, Michigan, and earned a JD of Law degree from the University of Michigan. She served as a law clerk for the Honorable Bernard Friedman and practiced law. Since 2010, she's been the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan, thereby becoming the first woman to serve in this position. Her name, Barbara McQuaid, and we're honored to have her as our guest. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Barbara McQuaid, the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan. Ms. McQuaid, welcome. A real honor to have you.
Thanks very much. Glad to be here.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your mom and your dad?
Well, I was blessed to grow up in a great home with a very loving mom and dad and an older sister. And I think if anyone's responsible for any success I've had in life, it's them. My mother taught me the great value of organization. She was a meticulous list maker and list keeper. And my dad was a great ally for a girl growing up in a time when a lot of doors were closed to girls, for making me believe anything was possible.
What were you like, Barbara, as a young girl?
Well, I guess most people in that era probably would have described me as a tomboy, a girl who loved sports and dreamed of a career as a lawyer or debater or something like that. And a lot of people, told me that those were not things that girls did. And so I give all the credit in the world to my dad, who was a great ally and encouraged me to follow my dreams.
Where did you get your love for law?
Well, I've always been inspired to correct injustices. Again, just seeing doors closed to girls made me have a passion for equality and wanting to see people treated fairly. And anytime I've seen an injustice anywhere, I've felt a great affront and a desire to correct it.
Why did you choose a career in law?
Well, I guess just trying to right wrongs. I started actually as a journalist. I worked for a year for a newspaper after college in Rochester, New York, and I was always turned on by Watergate, the paper chase, the Woodward and Bernstein, and kind of exposing the wrongs of people in positions of authority. And so I think that investigative journalists and prosecutors have a lot in common, trying to be a watchdog for society. And so I've always been attracted to that kind of role.
I've heard the term a few times through the years, the calling of law. What does that mean?
Well, I don't know that it's a calling the way a religious person is called, so I don't want to diminish that religious calling by comparing it to what I do. But I am highly motivated to work in the law to seek justice and improve the lives of other people and use the law as a tool to improve the quality of life for people.
1998, you go to work for the U.S. Attorney's Office. Why did you do that?
Since I had been a law clerk for Judge Friedman in the early 1990s, I had a chance to see for myself in court what prosecutors do. And to me, it was all the same reasons I had gone to law school, seeking justice, trying to help people who are victims to become whole, trying to right injustices. So seeing that in action right in our community, I very much wanted to be a part of that.
From 98 through 2009, you served with the U.S. Attorney's Office 12 years. What are the biggest things, Barbara, you learned in those 12 years?
Well, as a prosecutor, I learned the importance of fairness, of always disclosing every aspect of your case because you want to achieve justice for everyone, and that justice is important in reality and in perception. You have to make sure that people feel that the system is fair, and so doing everything we can to conduct ourselves in a way that is transparent is essential to achieving true justice.
A lot of people today think there's two sets of rules. One for the people in power, and then another for the common folk. What do you say to those people?
Well, some of our institutions are set up in such a way that that is sometimes the reality. I don't think the rules are designed that way or intended to be that way, but in practice, sometimes they are. People who have a lot of wealth can afford a very expensive lawyer, and sometimes that can make a difference for people. And so I think that we on the prosecution side have an obligation to make sure that people are treated fairly. And I will say we certainly go after targets who are people of power or wealth just as much as we do of people who are without those things.
When you come up against one of these people with power and they have this terrific lawyer and the lawyer's just throwing out a lot of lies, what are you thinking to yourself?
Well, I don't know that we have lawyers who are throwing out a lot of lies. Frankly, the high-priced lawyers are often very good and very effective, but they have the ability to mount a very vigorous defense, filing a lot of motions and making us work harder. But I think that we rise to the occasion and we make sure we work just as hard against those lawyers as we do against others.
We're talking to Barbara McQuaid. When we come back, we'll ask her about being confirmed by the U.S. Congress on Christmas Eve, 2009. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula, and we're with Barbara McQuaid, who since 2010 has been the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan, thereby becoming the first woman to serve in this position. Christmas Eve 2009, U.S. Congress confirms you to be U.S. Attorney. What happened the next day, Christmas 2009?
Well, it's an interesting story because, as you said, I was confirmed on Christmas Eve. And the reason I was confirmed on Christmas Eve, as you may recall, that was the day that Congress was asked to stay very, very late, much later than usual, to pass Obamacare. Ooh. And so they stayed much later than usual. And then as a result, they said, well, and let's confirm all these extra people who haven't been confirmed yet. So I was one of them. And many, many people got confirmed that day. And I thought, this is a terrific Christmas present. I'm going to have a great holiday with my family, enjoy some quiet time, and what could go wrong now? And the very next day, Christmas Day, I received a message on I was using a BlackBerry in those days, on my BlackBerry, that an Al-Qaeda operative had attempted to blow up a plane at Detroit Metro Airport. And so suddenly we were off to the races.
The famous underwear bomber. Tell us about that whole case.
Well, it was an extraordinary case. A man named Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab, a true Al-Qaeda operative, he was a graduate student in England, had traveled to Yemen to get training with Al-Qaeda, and they immediately recognized his value because he was a fluent English speaker with a valid visa to travel to the United States. So they tasked him with using this new bomb that was made entirely of plastic with powder explosives in it to fly over U.S. soil on a U.S. airliner and blow up a plane. And that's what he set out to do.
And thank God it didn't work.
Yeah, we don't know why. The powders did succeed in creating a fire on board the plane, and passengers quickly put it out. So the bomb didn't go up. But if it had, it would have been an incredibly devastating event in the history of Detroit. You know, when you think about sometimes people criticize us for overreacting for terrorist events. Imagine if he had been successful on Christmas Day 2009. We would have the years later retrospective, where were you on Christmas Day 2009? Because not only would he have killed 289 passengers on board that plane, but also was right over Telegraph Road in Woodhaven. He would have killed many people on the ground there. It was about 11 a.m. on Christmas morning. So think about the disruption and death and devastation that would have occurred there. And I also always tell people that it's a great reminder that a terrorist attack can occur any place, any time, because he only chose Detroit because he first tried Houston and the plane ticket was too expensive. Then he asked about Chicago and Los Angeles, and they didn't have enough money for those either. But then when he asked, what do you have for less than $400? The answer was nonstop from Amsterdam to Detroit.
Tell us, Barbara, about the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Eastern District of Michigan.
Well, it's a wonderful group of incredible professionals, people who are very, very talented and could be working anywhere but choose to serve the public with their talents, and I'm very grateful that they do. We have 115 lawyers and about another 100 support staff. Most of those people work in Detroit with a handful in Flint and Bay City to service the northern parts of our district.
You took office in January, and first thing you did was restructure the office for the first time in more than 35 years. What did you do?
Well, when the structure was first originated in the 1970s, we had about 35 lawyers. We had grown to 115 and a number of new challenges. So we wanted to align our attorney resources with the challenges we face today, things like terrorism and national security, identity fraud and cybercrime, healthcare fraud, theft of trade secrets from our auto companies. And so we have now aligned our office to address some of those threats, and I think we're working very busily to address them.
You and your team have five main priorities. If we could walk through each. First one, national security.
Well, as I mentioned, a terrorist attack can occur anywhere, anytime, any place. In addition to acts of terrorism, we're also protecting our border from things like export violations. You know, Michigan's technology is a very precious commodity. Our auto companies invest millions of dollars in research and development into being a worldwide leader in auto technology, and there are nation-state competitors who want to steal that. We've had two cases involving Chinese nationals who have attempted to steal trade secrets from some of our big auto companies, and we have had successful prosecutions against them.
Number two, violent crime.
Well, violent crime continues to plague not only Detroit, but Pontiac, Flint, Saginaw, other cities within the Eastern District of Michigan that we serve. And I think until we get a handle on violent crime, none of our cities are going to be the kind of cities we want them to be, the kind of cities our residents deserve. And so we've worked very hard to tackle violent crime in Detroit. We've initiated a program we call Detroit One. It's a great strategy, and we've seen some results where we bring together federal, state, and local law enforcement partners to work at the precinct level with Detroit police officers who know who are the most violent people in their communities. And by bringing all of those resources together in a coordinated way to focus on those same trigger puller offenders, we hope to have an impact on violent crime. In fact, last year we saw the fewest homicides in Detroit since 1969. Still far too many, but at least trending in the right direction. Another key component to that Detroit One strategy is bringing in the community to be our partners as well. We need the community to be part of the solution and defeat that no-snitch mentality that we sometimes see in communities where people are afraid to report crimes, or maybe they feel like, why report it, because nothing's going to happen anyway. And we're hopeful that the improved response to criminal reports, the improved closure of homicide cases, will give people confidence that it is worthwhile to put yourself out there and share that information with the police.
Third main priority, white-collar crime.
We have seen a real surge in this area in healthcare fraud in particular, and all kinds of fraud, mortgage fraud, and we really want to put a stop to those things. We hope that our work will have a deterrent effect. In the healthcare fraud arena, the most egregious case we have seen is a doctor out of Oakland County who was falsely diagnosing patients with cancer so that he could administer expensive chemotherapy treatments and bill Medicare, and he did for $34 million. And when this case was exposed by a whistleblower in his office, I was very proud of the work of our team, who was able to put together search warrants and arrest warrants over just a few days in a very complex case. But they recognized the urgency they were dealing with, because every day that went by, they knew that real people were being hurt. And so although those patients were, many of them, relieved to learn that they did not have cancer, that was wonderful news, but they were very hurt and betrayed and angry that in the meantime they had developed all of the awful side effects that can accompany chemotherapy, like nerve damage and organ failure and loss of teeth. And so those are some permanent injuries. We're hoping to obtain restitution for them with the $12 million in assets that we were able to seize from him.
The fourth main priority, civil rights.
civil rights is very important because I think Michigan is a community that wants to attract population. And for us to grow, we want to be a beacon to the world. That means we've got to protect the rights of everybody who comes here to send a message that everyone is welcome here. So we created the first ever civil rights unit in the office, and they've been very busy. We've had wonderful cases protecting the rights of the disabled, getting wheelchair ramps on city buses as a result of our litigation, wheelchair ramps at polling places in Flint, sign language interpreters for patients at health systems and hospitals that previously didn't have them. We've protected the rights of our gay community from hate crimes, people who have been refused housing based on their race. So I'm very proud of the work that's that unit has done, and I'm hopeful that for every case we have, not only are we vindicating the rights of an individual, but we're causing organizations to change policies to be more welcoming for everybody.
The fifth one is public corruption. And we're talking to Barbara McQuaid. When we come back, we'll ask her specifically, Kwame Kilpatrick. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rasula, and we're with Barbara McQuaid. Barbara, the fifth priority, public corruption. And that brings us to Kwame.
Well, when I first started, the Kilpatrick investigation was underway. He had been convicted already in the state system by Kim Worthy, who did a wonderful job. But there was that was simply on the perjury case involving his wrongful termination of Gary Brown relating to his extramarital affair with Christine Beattie. What remained unresolved was the enormous public corruption extortion scheme that he'd been involved with. And so we worked very hard. We created a standalone public corruption unit to make sure that we had attorney resources who could dedicate all of their time to that case and the related cases that came with it and other cases of public corruption throughout our district. But they worked very hard on that case to get it indicted within 6 months of my arrival and ready for trial, because it had lasted for a long time. People were ready for this case to come forward. But we were really the beneficiaries of a couple things. One is, once he left office, suddenly people were willing to talk to us who had not been willing to talk to us before. So I give Kim Worthy a lot of credit for that, for enabling us to get information we needed. The other source I give a lot of credit to is the Detroit Free Press that broke the text message scandal. And we were then able to get a search warrant to get all of those text messages. And they were a treasure trove of evidence for us because it corroborated the stories we were hearing from witnesses. We had live witnesses to put on the stand who were going to tell compelling stories. But witnesses can be impeached with bias motivations and other things. But when you have objective text messages between Kwame Kilpatrick and his associates confirming everything those witnesses were saying, then it became an incredibly solid case.
It was an $84 million extortion scheme, and Barbara, 34 of his administrators were convicted.
Yeah, I think people may not realize that it wasn't just Kwame Kilpatrick, but so many of the people who worked with him. And it's a great example of how power at the top can really corrode an entire organization. The corruption becomes like poison, and many of the people in his organization watched how he did business and did it the same way. Why do your job for free when you can demand some money in exchange for doing your job? Seemed to be their game plan. Many of them set up their own nonprofit consulting companies, and you had to make a donation before you could get someone to do their job. You had to pay Bernard Kilpatrick, his father, Maestro, a consulting fee if you wanted to do business with the city. So a lot of things like that became the culture of doing business in the city of Detroit. And we're very proud to have convicted not only Kwame Kilpatrick, but others in that administration so that we could really clear the way and change that culture. You know, then we saw Dave Bing come in, who I think does not get enough credit for restoring dignity and honor to the office of the mayor, who then led us to where we are now, where we're having a lot of good success, I think, in allowing, honest people who not only want to lead in the city of Detroit, but who want to do business in the city of Detroit. There are a lot of honest businesses who said, I'm just not going to do business in the city of Detroit because I don't want to have to pay extortion fees in exchange for a contract with the city. So we hope that we have opened the doors back to those good people who would otherwise stand on the sidelines, who are now in Detroit and I hope thriving.
If there's a listener from the city tonight that says, wow, you're impressive, but when you say, hey, come forward and tell us what's going on, you don't live in this city. You know, we're afraid to say what's going on at times. What would you say to those people?
Well, we certainly understand that. There are a lot of reasons people are afraid to share information. One is retribution from the wrongdoer. You know, if you're going to report someone who's involved in drug trafficking or violent crime, there's certainly a valid reason to be afraid. Sometimes I think people don't trust the police, don't trust them to be effective, and so I'm going to give you this information, nothing's going to happen with it. Or I don't trust that the criminal justice system is fair and that justice will be served. So what I would say to them is that we understand those concerns and we're doing a lot of things to address it. One, if you're simply afraid that the criminal will find out who you are, we use Crime Stoppers, which is an anonymous source, 1-800-SPEAK-UP, where people can call and report a tip. And that is a very important source. They are truly anonymous. In some instances, they provide a reward. So if you're really afraid, that's one mechanism that you can use. The other is I want to assure people that we will work hard with a tip. We will not ignore tips, so you can feel that your tip will be worthwhile if you share it with us. And the other is, in extreme situations, we do have funds for witness protection. We have, you know, the very extreme that I think most people wouldn't want to do, where you change your identity and move somewhere far away. But short of that, we have some other intermediate measures for protection, protecting people with alarm systems in their homes or short-term relocation to protect people when someone has been charged with a crime. So we will work with people who want to work with us to share information to try to reduce crime.
In the previous segment, you talked about Dr. Fareed Fada, but I quote you now. This is the most serious fraud case in the history of our country. How bad was it?
Well, I think we came to that conclusion in preparing our sentencing memorandum, because one of the things you're supposed to do is try to find uniformity with other cases around the country. And so we looked for other cases around the country, and we couldn't find anything even close. You know, there's the Bernie Madoff case of, you know, financial fraud, where people lost millions of dollars and certainly were devastated financially. But this was a case where he lied to people about whether they had cancer. My father died of cancer. I think most people have been touched by cancer in one way or another. And I think all of us understand the kind of trust you have to put in your doctor when you reach that situation in your life. And the idea that your doctor would betray that trust and tell you you have cancer when you do not is just unconscionable. And so that's why we thought that this was the most egregious case we had ever seen, and someone who was deserving of the maximum penalty under the law.
Let's talk about some other governmental agencies that support you and your team. First, the FBI.
The FBI is a wonderful partner. We work with them frequently. The special agent in charge, Paul Abate, is a wonderful partner. I talk with him several times a week. They have a broad mission of investigating violent crime, white-collar crime, terrorism, and national security. But we rely on those agents to help us do the investigation that we need to put together a prosecution. So they're doing the witness interviews. And we work very closely with them when developing an investigative strategy, which is actually one of the most enjoyable parts of the job. Do we want to try to get a search warrant here? Well, if we do, then the case is overt. Maybe we need to do some covert things first before we do that. Can we do surveillance? Can we have someone get consensually recorded phone calls? Can we establish the probable cause to get a wiretap? We do a number of things, including looking through people's trash from time to time. All of those things to build the evidence that we need to put a case together. And we're very grateful to the agents of the FBI and other agencies for doing that hard work and sometimes very dangerous work out on the streets interviewing people who sometimes don't want to talk to them to give us the evidence that we need to put together a case.
The Post Office.
The Postal Inspection Service is a wonderful organization. They uncover all kinds of crimes, mail fraud being one of them. You know, anytime you use the mail in furtherance of a scheme to defraud, that violates a statute, and they can help us with that. They do other things. Sometimes people use the mails to mail contraband, everything from child pornography to drugs, and they can help us with those cases. Sometimes the Postal Service are the victims of crimes, too. You know, when you think about your letter carrier, delivering your mail every day. They talk about rain, sleet, and snow. What they often don't talk about is in violence and dogs. And sometimes we have had letter carriers who have been attacked on their routes. I had a letter carrier who was stabbed on her route. We've sometimes had them robbed at gunpoint because sometimes there are checks and cash in their trucks. And so the Postal Inspection Service investigates those cases as well.
Okay, the next one. Before you go saying this one is a wonderful partner, like you did the FBI is a wonderful partner, tell us about the IRS.
Also a wonderful partner.
No.
Now, I know nobody likes to pay their taxes, but I am sure people would
acknowledge. That's an oxymoron if I've ever heard of it.
But I'm sure people would at least acknowledge that it is the law. The IRS is a great asset in financial cases. In fact, in the Kilpatrick case, the IRS criminal investigations participated in that case to demonstrate that Kwame Kilpatrick and other co-defendants had failed to pay proper income taxes because they had failed to declare all that extortion income on their taxes. And they do a wonderful job of putting together financial analysis. They'll look at bank records, they'll look at tax returns, and they'll put together some very nice charts to make it very understandable for a jury to see we've got all this income coming in and only this small portion of it being reported. And so, frankly, those are probably the strongest charges in the indictment because they can be demonstrated objectively on paper without requiring some witness to tell a story that someone may or may not believe.
The ATF.
Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. These are some very brave individuals. They are currently involved in many cases involving gang violence. We have a number of violent street gangs in Detroit, and ATF has been a valuable partner in combating those cases. We just had a conviction on Monday of a large violent street gang involved in things like carjackings with guns, armed robberies, home invasions, the kinds of things that really impact the quality of life in Detroit. And so we give ATF a lot of credit for investigating and prosecuting those cases.
We're talking to Barbara McQuaid, and I'm Jack Rasula. And this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible. And we're talking to Barbara McQuaid, U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan. Barbara, talk to us about the job our police departments and the men and women of law enforcement are doing in these cities.
Well, we've seen a lot of problems with police and community trust in the past year between Ferguson, Missouri, and Baltimore, Maryland. A lot of unrest. And I think it comes from, I've read all of the documents in the Ferguson case. There develops a rift, a sense of the system is not working for us. When you look at the way, not only was it the police would hassle people for low-level crimes, but the court system became almost a sort of debtor's prison there, where if someone had an unpaid ticket, and it was the price would escalate and escalate until person became imprisoned. And so there was a lot of anger about that system. And someone has described it as, the shooting of Michael Brown was the spark in a very dry forest with no reservoir of goodwill. And so when that spark happened, people didn't really care what the facts were. They were angry, and this ignited their anger. And I think we've seen that in other places. And it's true in other parts of the country. I think the Detroit Police Department works very hard to engage with the community. You know, some of the recommendations that have come out as a result of these instances is the president's commission on 21st century policing with some best practices. And the Detroit Police Department has already implemented many of those. You know, for several years, they were under a consent judgment with the Department of Justice for unconstitutional police practices, use of excessive force, the unlawful arrest of material witnesses, deplorable conditions of confinement, and over those years worked very hard to clean up those problems. But I think they've gone above and beyond in terms of doing things like engaging with the public. Just a couple weeks ago, I was with Chief Craig with an outreach event with the LGBT community. They are working very hard to get body cameras on all of their police officers, which is a great thing because it keeps everybody accountable. Not only does it protect the public from police misconduct and memorializes police misconduct, but it also protects the officers from frivolous accusations that they've done something wrong. So I think it makes everybody behave a little better just knowing that it's being recorded and that there's a camera there. So I think the police department is working hard to try to improve community relations, because all of us know that the police are more effective when the community it serves has its trust.
We're talking to Barbara McQuaid, the first woman to serve as U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan. Barbara, who's been the most influential mentor, and what's the biggest thing that he or she has taught you?
Well, I've had some very good mentors. Saul Green, the U.S. attorney who hired me, certainly is a mentor. My parents were mentors. But probably Judge Bernard Friedman, my first boss after I graduated from law school. And, you know, he taught me about the importance of just being nice to people. What goes around comes around. He has a story he tells about mountains never meet, but men do. You're going to see people again. And so if you just treat them nicely, that the next time you encounter them, they're likely to treat you nicely. It's very simple advice, but I think it pays big dividends in the world.
What makes a great judge?
A judge, one, I appreciate a judge who is just going to be nice to the litigants. That's a really big deal, and not all of them are, unfortunately. You want to know that a judge is giving everybody a fair shake. They may not agree with your position, but you want to feel like they read everything you submitted, so they were prepared, which takes some time. It's some homework. That they were prepared, they read everything that you submitted, they listened when you were giving an oral argument, and that they considered everyone's position carefully, and then issued a ruling promptly. All of those things are important, and I think that I've had rulings go my way, and I've had them go against me. But if they do all of those things, you accept it and you move on. And I think that's important to not just justice, but the perception of justice.
Speaking of being nice, our mutual friend, Judge Fred Mester, he once shared a quote with me from Socrates. I quote now Socrates, "A great judge has four traits: hear courteously, answer wisely, consider soberly, and decide impartially."
Well, certainly all of those I would agree with.
You mentioned listening. Listening is wanting to hear. You are a fabulous listener. How does one learn to become a great listener?
Well, I don't know that I'm a great listener. I think it's something I'm still working on. And I think in this modern age, it's become more difficult. We are so distracted by our electronic devices. I know I'm often distracted by it. So it is difficult. But I think there's some skills for listening. One is your posture. I mean, I'm sitting on the edge of my seat right now because it helps me to stay engaged. When I'm listening, I frequently take notes, even if I never go back and look at those notes. By writing things down as I listen, it's causing me to think about what I'm writing and what I'm hearing. So I think there are some skills you can use to be a better listener and to make sure that you're engaged as you're listening, sort of active listening.
First and primary, you're a mom. Tell us about that role.
It's my most important role, and it's a role I love. I have four children, and I enjoy it very much. I suppose, like all working moms, I struggle between the guilt of, am I spending enough time with my children, and am I spending enough time on my job, and never satisfied with the amount of time I'm spending on either. But my children are my greatest joy, and I've been accused of overparenting and being a helicopter parent, and I say I can't love them enough.
Barbara McQuaid, you're a five-star athlete. And most any law firm in America would love to hire you and pay you very handsomely. Very handsomely. Why not do it?
Well, I love the job that I have, and I will continue to do it for as long as I can. I often say to people as I'm hiring them to become assistant U.S. attorneys that you might earn more money in the private sector, but we get rich in other ways. The work that we do, to me, is invaluable. The ability to shape policy in our community, to protect the rights of victims, to improve the quality of life in the community, you just cannot put a price on that.
What do you say to a young person considering a career in law?
Well, I think sometimes people are concerned that that the legal profession is oversubscribed, that there are too many people who are lawyers. But I will say that there are there's always room for more good lawyers, and that law is always evolving such that we do need lawyers. You know, you think about evolving areas like technology right now, the cybersecurity issues and the law relating to that. In our field, in criminal world, the issues involving getting the right kind of search warrant or process for email accounts and text messages and GPS locators is always evolving. And so you're always going to need lawyers who can address those cutting edge issues. And so I would advise people that if you want to be a lawyer, study hard, work hard, and follow what you love.
Why consider a career in public service today?
I think it is the greatest thing that anybody can do. Our country needs talented people serving in the all levels of government. We need people from diverse backgrounds. We want different perspectives so that we can best serve our people. It is an incredibly satisfying career. And as I said, although you might not earn a lot of money, you can get rich in many other ways. The satisfaction that you feel from improving your community.
What makes a great public servant?
Well, first, serving for the right reasons, wanting to serve. We've seen corrupt public servants who are serving for the wrong reasons. They thought that by getting power, it would come with it fame and prestige and money. And so those are certainly the wrong reasons. But what makes a great public servant, I think, is wanting to help other people, not worrying about who gets the credit for that help, and working hard.
Talk to us about serving as a juror in a jury trial.
Sometimes people want to get out of being a juror, and I never understand it, because by the end, they're usually so happy they had a chance to do it, because it's so interesting and so enlightening. Sometimes our jury trials might last only a day. Other times, as in the Kilpatrick case, it might last 6 months. But I think, with rare exception, those jurors find that the process was incredibly educational, very satisfying, and enjoyable. They become friendly with each other. They're working on a common problem. They're very focused, and they're following judges' instructions and evidence to reach a very, very important decision. The jury in the Kilpatrick case became very good friends. They have gotten together, I know, after rendering the verdict in that case. And it's so important because, there were jurors on that case from all over the area. It was a very diverse jury. And there was a woman on the jury who said afterwards, I voted for Kwame Kilpatrick as mayor twice, but what I heard in this courtroom made me sick to my stomach, and I had no choice but to vote to convict him. So I think she is probably proud of her service and knows that she did an important public service for her community.
As our time winds down together this night, what advice to give to our young listeners?
I'd say three things in life to be successful. Work hard, tell the truth, and make a list. It helps you prioritize and organize your thoughts.
Ms. McQuaid, you are a shining example of a government servant. And friends, of all the questions I asked her tonight, the one where she gave the biggest smile was the one I said, talk to us about being a public servant. Keep up the great work. Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spawn.